This is a recording of the Michael Lerner teleconference with Commonweal on March 22nd, 2006 at 11 o'clock a.m. Central Time.
Other colleagues onto that call.
This is Jimmy Spiro from the University of California, Davis, and it's sunny here, and I'd be very interested in commenting on integrity of science relating to the EPA.
Okay.
Kennedy is editor and former MP.
Thanks, Pete. Pete, we don't hear you that well, so maybe you could work on your microphone a little bit, make sure that you come in clearly for the call. Great. So let's just do a check to see so far for our speakers. I heard Pete Myers is on. Welcome, Pete. Do we have Diane Dumanowski?
Yes, I'm on.
Welcome, Diane. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Theo, I think I heard you. You're on, right?
I'm on, yes.
Perfect.
I like this. Turn my volume down on the phone. Can you hear me well on this?
Oh, we can hear you very well.
Okay, I won't worry about it then.
Thank you. As I mentioned a couple of minutes earlier, we are planning our April 28th call next month. That's the date for the partnership call. And I heard, I think it was David Speer who's interested in commenting. We will get in touch with you, sir. But that date is April 28th at 9 a.m. Pacific, and we will be talking about the integrity of science.
And you're going to have a transcript from today, are you?
Yes, we will have an audio MP3 file for instant download on the line, probably within a week or two, and then our transcripts will be up within a week or two as well.
Thank you. Hi, Eleni, it's Steve.
Welcome, Steve. Steve will be moderating today.
Hey, Jillian.
Welcome to the call.
Hello.
Hi.
It was Jimmy Spiro, not...
thank you.
David
Jimmy Spiro? Great. We will get your contact information off of our CQ list. Thank you.
Eleni, I can help you with that. I know.
Great.
Hi, this is Andy Edgar online.
Welcome, Andy, to the call.
Rich Baroff here.
Hi, Rich. It's Diane.
Hi, Diane. Hello, hello.
Nice to hear your voice.
Nice to hear your voice.
Center for Women and Families. Welcome to the call.
Hi, this is Pat Hilgard from EPA, and say hello to Theo. We haven't seen her for a while.
Hi, good morning, Pat. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Jeannie Rizzo, Breast Cancer Fund.
Hi, Jeannie.
Kathleen Atfield from Silent Spring Institute.
Harry Christensen, DEF Action.
Nice Rizzo.
LDA.
Rizzo,
University of Akron.
Lois Vanessa Zetko, Reproductive Health Technologies Project.
Wonderful. Welcome to the call.
Joe Isaacs with Resolve, the National Infertility Association.
Morning, Joe.
Morning.
Jeff Anderson here, San Rafael.
The Healthcare Without Harm.
Thank you.
Harold.
Hi, Amy Constant from EMS Science Communication Network.
Harold Ant from Freeport, Maine.
Carolyn Wysocki, Echo in Connecticut.
Tessa Kowalski, Michigan Environmental Council.
Sally Grady, OSHA.
Keith Gilbert, Dow, Washington.
University.
Welcome.
Liberty Goodwin, Toxics Information Project, Providence, Rhode Island.
Welcome.
Hi, Brittany.
Murphy, Mass General Hospital.
As I've mentioned, we have close to 200 people, wonderful voices on the line. I think we'll give it just a few more seconds. Pete, can we just do a sound check with you?
How's this? Is that okay?
Yes, that's great. Thank you.
Julia, is that you speaking? Is that networking, Julia, or Susan? Who is that? Who's doing most of the speaking?
Oh, that's Eleni.
Eleni?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Eleni, this is Jen Howe in Boston. I just wanted to say that I hear you much louder than I hear everybody else.
Yeah, Pete was pretty dim there.
Yeah, Pete was dim.
Can we get you?
Okay, well, we'll
sorry,
work
on that. I'm just saying, if I turn my volume up, I think I might be deafened by Julia. So that I don't know if she can do anything. I mean, Alina, sorry.
Eleni. Yeah, I'll try to. Hopefully, it's a little better now.
Thank you.
Okay, great.
And how about Theo and Diane?
Can you hear me?
Hi, Theo. It's Vinny Jerry.
Hi, Vinny. Yeah, we can always. Theo, you always come in crystal.
Theo's great, yeah.
Okay, so I think we'd like to begin. We're 4 minutes after. I'm going to ask David, our operator for today's call, to please place everyone except for the speakers in listen only mode.
Okay, we're doing. Okay, I'll be just 1 second.
All right, thanks.
Okay, all lines are now muted.
Great. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to this call. My name is Eleni Sotos. I am the National Coordinator of the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. Today's teleconference is called Endocrine Disruption and Environmental Health, 10 Years After Our Stolen Future. Moderating this call will be Steve Heilig. He is the Director of Public Health and Education at the San Francisco Medical Society and the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. Please note that we have posted on our CHE website some relevant articles and resources pertaining to today's topic. If you'd like to view these resources and you are at a computer, please go to www.healthandenvironment.org. That is the CHE website. And then on the homepage, click on the first link under the What's New section on the left side of the screen. And if you click on the link titled March 22nd CHE Partnership Call, that will take you to a page that has background information and resources, and just click on that. Before we begin, I'd like to cover some important logistical information regarding the call. Please note that everyone on the call, with the exception of our speakers, has been placed in listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentations, the operator will unmute everyone. You may participate in the Q&A period if you choose. To be mindful of the process during the Q&A period, please identify yourself before you speak, and please keep your comment or question brief, as we have probably about 200 people on the line today. This call will last 1 hour. It is being recorded, and an MP3 audio file and transcripts will be available on the website for download over the coming weeks. I'd also like to announce that the April National Partnership call has been scheduled. That date is Friday, April 28th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern. The topic will focus on the integrity of science. More details on this call will be sent out via email over the coming weeks to our CHE partners. I'd now like to turn the call over to Steve. Steve?
Thank you very much, Lenny. Am I coming through there?
Yes, you are.
Okay, thank you. Good morning and good day, everybody. This is obviously a very popular call, and not surprised, really. The idea for it came up about 6 months ago when I was looking for a reference for an article I was writing, and I reached for a book called Our Stolen Future, which still has a great bibliography in it. And then putting together an issue of the Medical Society's journal that all CHE partners will have access to soon on the various issues we're talking about, I asked the authors of Our Stolen Future to write a brief essay called A Decade Later, and that is one of the references that is available on the CHE website that Eleni mentioned. And at the same time, we thought, well, we should see if we can get all three of them together for a call, and sure enough, it's a very popular call. The book itself is popular, too, and how do you measure that? Nowadays, you can go to Google. And so if you Google the phrase, Our Stolen Future, as I did yesterday, you get 114,000 hits, and 780 of those before it starts to become redundant. Another way to measure it is Amazon.com, and yesterday it was number 17,916 in the popularity contest there, just behind a very famous book called The Power of Positive Thinking by Norman Vincent Peale, which has sold 7 million copies. So the speakers today asked me to do a very brief introduction to the book. I have a feeling many people here have read it, but very briefly, in 1950, there was the first study in literature in an obscure journal called The Proceedings of the Society of Experimental Biology and Medicine, which indicated that DDT, the pesticide, exerted estrogen-like action. A dozen or so years later, of course, in 1962, Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, came out and mentioned this somewhat, but focused more on cancer and on the effects in birds and wildlife. And then a quarter century after that, 10 years ago, Our Stolen Future, or OSF, as it's known by many people. And in the preface by then Vice President Al Gore, he called it a sequel to Silent Spring. So why was this book so important, and why are we marking it today? Well, I would say there's five reasons, and the first is that it provided a very good synthesization of science and evidence that the chemicals put into use following the explosion of use after World War II were scrambling hormonal messages and creating what the authors called hormone havoc, which is the title of one of their chapters. They used evidence from over 4,000 studies, mostly in animals, and so there was mention of effects in eagles and otters, gulls, fish, polar bears, whales, etc. They talked about the concept of biomagnification, and then especially critiqued the long-standing paradigm of that the dose equals the poison. And they added the concept of developmental effects, especially in utero. A quote from here is, hormone-disrupting chemicals are not classical poisons or typical carcinogens. They defy linear logic of concurrent testing protocols built on the assumption that higher doses do more damage. Another reason is that they explored the evidence and implications for humans and waded into some controversial territory here, but they talked about DDT and DES, PCBs, dioxin, and the effects on things like sperm count, prostate and breast cancer, endometriosis, miscarriage, and learning and developmental disabilities. They moved beyond the cancer focus of previous views on chemicals and really broadened it to show that the impacts are not just on particular diseases but can be functional and what they called robbing human potential before birth. A third important aspect was that they made a list of action recommendations. It's chapter 12. It's called Defending Ourselves. And if you read those, you find that they are still valid and needed, and we hope to get a bit of a progress report on some of that today. And fourth, very important, this is what was called a scientific detective story. They used real people, meaning the some of the people on this call and our speakers, to create what the Washington Post called an environmental thriller. And this is very important. That's why it's on Amazon still, I would say, at this point, because it wasn't a dry book. It's a very fascinating read. And last and not least, from our perspective here, since this is a Che call, if you look at the Che consensus statement, you will see that the perspectives, the science there, underlie much of what we are doing. It's in part of the mission and very much a part of the consensus statement and what we try to do. So we're going to have our speakers today in the same order that they were in the book, and listed on the book anyway. And Dr. Thiel Colborn, the first chapters actually detail her 7 years of synthesizing what was known. She is currently president of the Endocrine Disruption Exchange and has worked with the World Wildlife Fund, the US EPA, the United Nations, National Research Council, and received in 2004 the Rachel Carson Award from the Center for Science and the Public Interest. One fascinating thing about her, I think, inspiring really, is that she started grad school in this area at age 51 rather than going back to be a pharmacist, which she had been before. And when I looked at Amazon, you know, readers can put their own review on there. And the first Amazon review sounds like a star encounter is called I Met Theo Colborn. And it is from a woman who says, quote, at a nutrition conference, I sat down with my meal and an Nalgene water bottle. As I sat down, a woman I had seen speak earlier that day spouted out, don't drink out of that bottle. I was quite taken aback, but her statement opened a long conversation about toxins in foods and containers. After saying goodbye, I read her book on the airplane. Even though it is a thick scientific book, I couldn't put it down. For all who care about our future, this is a must-read book. So we start today with Dr. Colborn.
Well, I'll have to find out who that lady was. First, I want to thank everyone at Che for making this call possible. I can think of no better way to celebrate. But as I open the discussion today, I want to point out that the science in our stolen future ended in 1994. We were only able to squeak in a few early 1995 citations before the book went to print. Actually, the science in our stolen future is now 12 years old. Even so, by that time, the floodgates had already started to open on the release of one new study after another about endocrine disruption in the peer-reviewed literature. Today, it is almost impossible to keep up with the rate of new literature and activities such as meetings, seminars, and teach-ins on a week-by-week basis associated with endocrine disruption. Since the book came out 10 years ago, vast evidence has accumulated confirming that we are in far deeper trouble than we ever anticipated while writing the book. Our stolen future definitely understated the problem. To get an idea about how endocrine disruption was discovered, let's look back to 1988, 8 years before OSF. To a Canadian report listing 16 top predators in the Great Lakes Basin that were suffering severe reproductive problems, even extirpation of some populations. The report revealed that the declines were associated with improper development of the wildlife offspring as a result of gestational damage either within the egg or the womb. Most of the adverse health endpoints reported in the animals were the result of disturbed endocrine function. and the extent of damage correlated with the increasing amounts of persistent organochlorine pollutants, the high-profile chemicals at that time in the maternal animals. It came as a shock to discover that traditional toxicological testing of chemicals had let vast numbers of synthetic chemicals through the regulatory safety net, and that no synthetic chemical had been tested for its effect on development and function before being released on the market. Then in July 1991, a group of 21 scientists from 17 different disciplines were invited to spend a secluded weekend at the Wingspread Conference Center, Racine, Wisconsin, to discuss the topic of chemically induced alterations in sexual development, the wildlife-human connection. Something remarkable happened there that led to the release of a consensus statement in September 1991 and a technical book in 1992. But a very difficult book for most people to understand. Nonetheless, that book lit a fire under academicians around the world, which started the flood of papers that were appearing in the peer literature as OSF went to the publisher. But it also started a less obvious but extremely well-funded flood of public relations efforts and tactical planning by international corporations and multinational trade associations to deny, lie, obfuscate, and confuse policymakers, regulatory agency personnel, and the public about endocrine disruption, which continues to increase today. Then in 1993, I was urged to write a book that everyone could understand, and that was when I turned to Pete and Diane and said, "Help me." Unfortunately, it is impossible for me to be optimistic as I sit here at TEDx with a database full of evidence that screams for attention. Because where do we turn now to say, help us? Think about this. I sat on three EPA committees set up to design screens and assays to test chemicals for their endocrine disrupting effects. Not once over those years was a discussion put on the table before the full committees from the academic community about their low-dose data and its implications in the endocrine feedback system. And at no time was there a possibility of setting aside traditional toxicological dogma. It was like being in a room and given some delicate needlework to complete and given a pair of pliers to do it. There is now a terrible disconnect between the science being done on college campuses and the science being done in commercial labs and by EPA. And there is also a terrible disconnect between what is being revealed on campuses with what is being used to determine public safety. I should say, however, that my team and I rejoice over every new discovery about how the endocrine system functions and is perturbed. And, of course, to the exciting announcement several weeks ago that, with environmental working groups prodding, DuPont has announced that it will begin to reduce the production of the Teflon-class chemicals. But in that case, only one corporation and one class of chemicals had to be dealt with. In the case of endocrine disruptors, practically every major corporation in the world is either producing or using them. We don't have 100 environmental working groups, and we have only a totally dysfunctional agency that after 10 years has not been able to offer up even one crude assay to detect endocrine disruption. Thank you. I'll turn this over to Diane.
Thank you.
Greetings all.
I will introduce Diane here, okay, just so people will know who we're hearing from. I have a feeling, with no insult meant to the other two authors, that she may be most responsible for the thriller aspect of the book. As a renowned environmental journalist dating back to Earth Day in 1970, and a TV and television reporter and producer focusing on environmentalism, writer for the Boston Phoenix and the Boston Globe, has been a Knight Fellow in science journalism at MIT, and has taught at Yale, where she has a graduate degree as well. So, Diane.
Greetings. This anniversary is an ideal time to reflect on how well we succeeded in communicating the complexities of endocrine disruption. I guess we did well on the thriller part, but how well did we put the ideas across? Our stolen future aimed, above all, to put this new kind of chemical hazard on the map. On the day Theo, Pete, and I sat down to talk about writing a book together, as Theo mentioned, there was already a book in print about endocrine disruption titled, and this takes a deep breath, Chemically Induced Alterations in Sexual and Functional Development, the Human-Wildlife Connection. It was the work of scientists who had participated in the historic Wingspread Conference, with each writing separate chapters from his or her disciplinary perspective. As its title suggests, it would never reach more than a very limited audience. Our reasons for writing a second popular book were remarkably similar to those that had inspired Rachel Carson to write Silent Spring 3 decades earlier. In her book, Carson first raised the question of how synthetic chemicals are affecting human health. Our book not only continued this investigation, it finally explained how synthetic contaminants caused the kind of reproductive failure in birds and other animals that Carson had described. Like Silent Spring, Our Stolen Future is a book written for non-scientists. The power of Silent Spring came not only from Carson's writing skill, but also from the fact that she took up a task that is largely neglected in the fractured and specialized world of modern science, the vital job of synthesis. She gathered pieces of evidence scattered across a variety of scientific disciplines, identified telling patterns, and attempted to see the broader picture. We had many of the same aims. We wanted to translate scientific information into more accessible language. We hoped to synthesize evidence scattered across many scientific disciplines and provide a more coherent picture than the snapshots from different angles assembled in the scientific book. We wanted to warn about unrecognized risk. We wanted to challenge the current framework for thinking about chemical hazards. But most of all, we believe the emerging evidence about endocrine disruption raised serious and urgent questions that needed to be answered. Chemicals that disrupt hormones and other chemical messages were an obscure phenomenon known at the time to only a small circle of scientists. We wanted to shine a spotlight on the problem to get public attention and to put the question on the public policy agenda. We hoped public concern would translate into more money for research, the research needed to answer the questions and better assess possible hazards. We hoped that more evidence combined with public concern would prompt regulation to remove compounds that sabotage development from production and from the environment. So, looking back over the past decade, how much of this did we accomplish? As we were writing the book, I judged that it would either make a big splash or sink like a stone in the dark pool of remaindered books. Our Stolen Future did make that big splash. We were wildly successful in putting many of our concerns on the map and getting press attention not only in the U.S. but around the world. But I was personally frustrated with the way reporters tended to handle the story. They often focused on one or two attention-getting symptoms, declining sperm counts, breast cancer, gender bending in wildlife, or types of hazards like plastics. More often than not, the story stopped there. They said little about the broader phenomenon. They addressed only pieces of the current coherent picture we had tried so hard to present. With such an approach, Tyrone Hayes' frog work, for example, is reduced to unfortunate things happening to frogs because of atrazine rather than an important piece of a much larger puzzle. Our Stolen Future, as mentioned, was also a concerted effort to push the discussion of chemical hazards beyond cancer. I think we've been partially successful in this regard. It was positively maddening when reporters chose to highlight possible connections between EDs and various cancers, even though there was far stronger evidence about disrupted development. But this was to be expected, since both journalists and editors were more comfortable with the old formula, toxic chemicals equal cancer. In fact, I never wrote a single word about EDs when I was at the Boston Globe, because as hard as I tried to sell the story, my editors could not get their minds around falling sperm counts and female gulls nesting together. Our most ambitious goal
I think, was to create a new overarching framework for the public discussion of chemicals. To do this, we had to challenge long-held assumptions in the public mind, in professional and scientific communities, and in government and regulatory agencies. In my view, the book has helped spur a profound conceptual shift, but we haven't fully accomplished the goal of expanding concern beyond cancer and high-dose exposure to developmental hazards and very low levels of exposure. While it is true that ubiquitous background levels, long assumed to be safe, have now become a matter of concern in some scientific and medical circles, I don't think the past 10 years have left the broader public with a clear notion of what this is all about. This may be due to many things: the inherent complexity of the ED phenomenon, the fragmented way the media has covered the story, and the choice at Wingspread of the umbrella term endocrine disruptors. I can testify from experience that the metaphoric punch of names like the ozone hole and acid rain helped greatly to communicate complicated problems to ordinary people. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Diane. Dr. John Peterson Myers, our third author and speaker, is a founder and CEO of Environmental Health Sciences, which is an organization engaged in advancing public understanding of environmental links to health, and also puts out environmental health news, which I hope every CHE partner is aware of and receives the newsletter from. As he has served as the director of the Alton Jones Foundation and has had senior positions at the National Audubon Society and Academy of Natural Sciences, and, of course, is co-author of OSF. So, Pete.
Thanks very much, Steve. And thanks to Diane and Steele. It was a wonderful ride writing the book and fantastic working. I look back and conclude that the most important thing we accomplished was stimulating investments, literally of hundreds of millions of dollars, into scientific research, and in the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere. And it's that investment that is producing the flood of new science that you have described, and which, it, as she said, is virtually impossible for one person to top of. The science, as we looked at it in 1996, was strong in some areas and others. It wasn't really ready to take the conclusions home to the bank in the public arena. What's come out since we've published has reinforced the concerns we raised and added many more. If anything, to reinforce what Theo said, we underestimated the magnitude. There have been several important trends in that new science, where scientists are seeing effects at even lower levels than we wrote about. Many more compounds are identified, implicated as being hormone disruptors. More hormone systems have been found to be vulnerable. And in fact, every time a scientist has looked carefully at part of the chemical machinery involved in controlling how genes are turned on and off, they have found examples of disruptions, not just the steroid hormone. One consequence of that is that a much broader array of health endpoints are now implicated, including a number of chronic diseases of adulthood, including one that we certainly didn't have in the book, which is obesity and related matters having to do with metabolic disorder. Another trend has been that the study of endocrine disruption scientifically has converged with another field in health studies, that of fetal developmental or developmental origins of adult diseases. And it's the combination of those two together give the paradigm great scientific strength. Now, you can look at this as a daunting issue, which it is, but I frankly also look at it and the emergence of this scientific understanding as a source of great hope. Collectively, science is linking environmental exposures to a wide array of health problems that today are imposing huge costs on society. In none of those are 100% of the cases likely to have been caused by exposure to endocrine disruptors. But some percentage is, and in some of the conditions, likely to be a large percentage. Those can be prevented by reducing exposures. In the discussions about the defunding of the National Children's Study, one of the scientists quoted in the press coverage of that said that this generation of children moving into adulthood likely to be the first in modern history less healthy than their parents. Science is coming out of the convergence of endocrine disruption and fetal origins of adult disease, giving us the opportunity to make sure that the next generation doesn't follow that same trend. I'm also encouraged because we're seeing new developments in the field of chemistry, specifically green chemistry, to redesign molecules so they can't interact with hormone systems but can be used as substitutes for compounds that we know are harmful. This field has a long way to go, being pulled forward by consumer demand and by entrepreneurial companies. We're seeing an economic opportunity to make money by making healthier products. Now, we're not there. I share some of Theo's pessimism, but I also think that the science has showed us a path along which we can move to make for a much healthier future. Thank you.
Thank you, Pete. We are going to move now into the question and answer period, so I would like to ask our tech person here if we could put people into talk-listen mode.
Yes, sir. All parties are now being joined in talk-listen.
And for everybody on here who may have a question, you will need to hit star and then six to demute yourself. And
actually, Steve, they need to hit star six to mute themselves first, and then if they want to...
I forgot I hadn't heard that.
Was not recognized. Please try again. Yeah. Press the star. Or can you...
I have one question. Let's, in the quote, endocrine disruption is a tough concept.
Your command was not recognized. Please try again. Press the star key before and after the command.
It's a tough concept to sell to the public because injuries are internal or invisible.
The line has been unmuted.
What image or images do you think could best communicate the message of endocrine disruption so the public gets it? And that is from Margaret Braun, who has authored a book on DDS stories with a foreword by Theo. Anybody want to take that? Anybody there, Pete? Diane?
Well, I think we have discussed this a lot. Theo doesn't agree with me, but I've always felt that endocrine disruptors is a bad term, which is what I said in my talk. And yet, the phenomena is so complex. In some cases you're talking about prenatal effects, adult effects, you're talking about wildlife, you're talking about humans, you're talking about a whole variety of diseases and dysfunction. And it's probably too late to have a contest to rename all of this. Pete, do you have any ideas?
I have back and forth. I think what the concept, what the phrase does, makes it too easy for people not to find a beat into understanding that a lot of hormone action is focused on changing gene behavior. And unless you've been steeped in genetics, I'm missing that point, and yet it is the crucial central point of this whole issue. So in retrospect, I think that the language may have hurt our ability to...
I can't hear you. Pete, you're gone.
You're gone now. I did hear some. Let's take another question.
Could I have a whack at that?
Go ahead.
I just want to remind everyone that the most difficult thing we had to decide at that meeting, because the people who were there obviously saw within the first 3 or 4 hours the problem we were facing. The difficult problem was coming up with the terminology, and we battled over that. It was very, very difficult at the time, but we had to come to some conclusion. But I think, and I'll be very frank with you, we were afraid to use the term fetus and embryo to talk about this topic. And we should have done it from the beginning, but politically we were advised not to. And I think that was where we made our mistake out of fear. Maybe the timing wasn't right, but I think the minute you start talking about that unborn child and what we're doing to that unborn child, we'll begin to make progress.
Thank you. Can we entertain a question now? Yes. And please keep them very brief and to your point.
Yes, this is Kathy Lawson, Healthy Children Project Director from the Learning Disabilities Association. This is sort of an obvious question. Do you think that there might be a sequel, maybe an OSF2 coming up?
Good question.
Hey,
I think you scared them, but go ahead.
Could I answer that?
Go ahead, Pete.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Periodically talked about that and had wanted to set aside time prior to the 10th anniversary, perhaps to get something down. But everyone's leading pretty busy lives. And so what we've done is tried to make the sequel a living sequel. So we use the website, Our Stolen Future, to at least help people keep up to date with where the science is going.
This is Diane. The problem, I think, is that the science has been moving so fast, far faster than the book
your
publishing.
Command is not recognized. Please try again. Press the star key before and after the command.
Sorry about that. Go ahead, Diane.
The science is moving far faster than the publishing industry moves, and I think that the reason that the website, the kind of like continuing unfolding of Our Stolen Future is preferable is that it doesn't get out of date. I mean, we even had the problem when we did Our Stolen Future that a lot of new science came out that, you know, by the time the book actually hit the streets.
Right. Okay, do we have another question?
Hi, my name is Andy Edgar, and I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I work at Clean Water Action.
Yes, go ahead, your question, please.
Great. I had a quick comment and a question.
Can we just have the
today
question?
Is my 29th birthday.
Can we just have the question, please?
Yeah. I was wondering what kinds of effects endocrine disruptors, or are there more in water, in food, in air? Where do you find them in terms of where they actually take place and how they get into the body?
Good question. Who wants to take that?
Well, I think you'll find them in every system. Endocrine disruptors now are in your home, everywhere, everything you touch. They become integrated into our lifestyle and our economy. Yes, they're in the water. Some people might be exposed to them through the water. Others are inhaling them. They're dermally absorbed through the skin. We breathe them in our homes, and your exposure shifts from minute to minute as you move about now. It would be great if we only had one or two chemicals to deal with. We have hundreds now. It's a very difficult question, but working with water, it's your job to really work and learn what is being found in water, what you can possibly get out of the water systems. We've got to find out how to purify our water. We don't have filtering systems to get a lot of these chemicals out.
Thank you. I'd just like to honor World Water Day today, too.
Oh, great.
Let me just add as a follow-up to that a question emailed in by a partner triggered by an environmental exposure. Is there any possible way to calm or halt the reactions?
Your command was not recognized.
Is there something that people can do to reverse or to stop the reactions that people get?
Operator, can you try to isolate that line, please? Thanks very much.
Anybody want to take that one?
Could you repeat it? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's just a question. Is there anything that an individual can do if they have a known or suspected problem related to endocrine disruption to halt reactions is the question.
Depends upon the specific impact and the timing of the impact. It's impossible to rewind the developmental tape. Same time, there are effects of some endocrine disruptors on adults, and some of those are not causing permanent changes. So it depends completely upon the chemical and the timing of impact and the endpoint.
Thank you, Pete. We have another question from a caller.
I have a question. Pressing problem. Which chemical? Perchlorates, or pick one that you're most concerned about.
I think the big one is bisphenol A, and I think Pete will confirm this. This is a simple, very small, 2-benzene ring molecule that apparently can get into all the cells in the body. Every system that has been tested in at low doses, it seems to disturb during development. It just became evident near the late 1990s. We have a database on this. And from 1990 until now, you just wouldn't believe the increase in the numbers of studies that are coming in from laboratories around the world. As scientists begin to hear about this chemical, they like to throw it into their systems and see what happens. And Pete, do you want to add to that?
I would concur with Theo. 95% of Americans are exposed to bisphenol A levels that when an adult mouse encounters it, it causes insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is one of the central problems in metabolic disorder linked to type 2 diabetes and obesity. 95% of Americans are exposed to levels sufficient in mice to cause that problem. Bisphenol A alters the expression of at least 200 genes. That's astounding. That's at least 1% of the human genome. It's a bad actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I concur. Bisphenol A is the top on my bad guy list.
And also the interesting thing is we missed it probably because it doesn't bioaccumulate. It's just that everyone is exposed to it so frequently and so often, it maintains about a 2 to 5 part per trillion, a part per billion level in the body at the range at which these tests are being done in the laboratory. So it's a sleeper, and industries work very hard to keep it a sleeper. And our government laboratory has just begun to do a study using this particular product.
But it was in our stolen future. We did raise a question about it.
Yes.
Just a quick question. Does that come from the plastic water bottles, like Dasani and stuff like that?
Mm-hmm. But it also...
No, it doesn't come from Dasani bottles. It comes from polycarbonate water bottles, the one brand of which is Nalgene. It also comes from linings in food cans, and there are other sources as well.
Those big jugs that they deliver spring water in are also polycarbonate.
But bisphenol A is also brominated, and it's used as a fire retardant. And so it's in and used on clothing, paper, paint on your walls. It's used in the glass in automobiles. It's great for basically producing a plastic product and then making it safe so you can ship it won't burn, has prevented probably a lot of fires. It's very much, as I said, an integral part of our talking to each other now on our telephones.
Thank you. Do we have another question?
This is Allison Carlson with the CHE Working Group on Infertility. And my question is that I understand that the proposed budget, national budget, includes a 30% cut in real dollars for endocrine disruptor research and the research infrastructure. And I'm wondering if the authors of Our Stolen Future have any comment about that, and I'm interested in whether there are groups who are organizing to look at that proposed budget cut.
Well, I have an associate in Washington who's been watching it very closely. It's just sad, extremely sad. That was the funding for and the direction that the EPA laboratories are taking, the research people, is away from getting at the basic science that's going to help us resolve our endocrine disruption problem. So the funding is shifting away from this type of thing. We tried several years ago to get a line item, additional money, for the Office of Research and Development. We got the money, and it was about $10 million. And at the end of the year, they could not decide how they were going to spend the money. And that money then went into paying salaries. We have to, the whole system needs to sit back. We've got to take a breath and say, we've got to start over. Because you don't even regulate these chemicals the way you would regulate the usual toxicant. We've got to think, it's the whole policy trail, it's the translation of the science into policy. We have real problems.
Thanks for that question, Allie. I think it's a tragedy. Now, with this decade of research reinforcing the questions, deepening them, broadening them, we're really seeing opportunities for prevention. Here they are contemplating pulling the base out from under this enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
The tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have another question, please?
This is Diana Zuckerman. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. I think it was Diane that talked about the importance of a catchy title, and you used ozone hole as a good example. But it wasn't clear to me whether you thought endocrine disruptors is catchy enough. I think it's difficult for a lot of people, but it just wasn't clear to me what you were saying, and I'm wondering if there's an easier term for people who are not necessarily scientifically oriented.
No, I share your concern, and I basically feel that the term endocrine disruptors is really problematic, and if you go back and read our Stolen Future, you'll find that the term appears very seldom in our Stolen Future, because it just doesn't communicate. And, you know, we have debated about what else we might call this, and nobody's come up with a really zingy, wonderful alternative term, although I think there might be some. But, you know, 10 years later, it's very hard to rename something.
Right.
I mean, we talked about stealth chemicals and chemical imposters and chemical sabotage, and, I mean, there are...
Sure. If
we
could use
the term
hormones, hormones might be, if you think that's an appropriate term, that would be...
No, because it's broader than that. It basically, you know, we did have a chapter called Hormone Havoc in our Stolen Future, but as Pete said, there are now other kinds of chemical messengers that aren't steroid hormones that are being disrupted. So it's basically a kind of chemical disinformation broadly.
It can be via
acting as an imposter or blocking messages, but it's a complete disruption of message systems. But I do think other terms would be helpful. And I don't know whether you can officially say we're not calling endocrine disruptors anymore. We're going to have a contest, and everybody on this conference call can put in their bid for the new term.
There's an idea. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, I could comment both about this one and a previous question. About this one, when I speak publicly about these issues now, I rarely use the term. And in fact, I just got an email from a symposium organizer in California, where I'll be in early May, who asked me to change the title so it was clear it was about endocrine disruption. I think it could interfere with getting about it, frankly.
Project, yeah. You mean it'd interfere if we change the name 10 years down the road?
No, yes. Well, it's here.
It's here.
But I will give an entire public speech without saying the phrase.
And so what are you calling it?
I talk about the fact of ways that the behavior is controlled, and broaden it to the range of chemical messengers that are essential to that process, and how chemical contaminants can hack the system. You're hacking a messaging system. But I did want to briefly get back to the bisphenol A point, because it circles around to an earlier comment that I made. I talked briefly about green chemistry in my first in my opening comments, and bisphenol A is a really good example of that, of the opportunities that this new science offers. Bottom line, bisphenol A is a problem because of the way it interacts with certain hormone receptors, and it can do that because of its shape, because of the molecular configuration of that molecule. What green chemists are actively doing right now is trying to figure out how can we change the shape of the molecule.
Operator, can you...
Yeah, we got it.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
How can you change the shape of the molecule so it can't fit in the estrogen receptor anymore, yet you can make plastic out of it? Now, they aren't done with this scientific exploration, but it's really opening up some interesting opportunities. And bisphenol A may become a poster child, both because of the bad stuff it does, but also because of the work undertaken to replace it.
Yeah, I'd actually like to follow up a little bit on that in a broader sense. In the chapter I mentioned, Defending Ourselves, you actually laid out a kind of agenda for improving protection, starting with shifting the burden of proof, et cetera. And I'm just wondering if any of you would like to give a grade or a progress report since the 10 years have gone by. How far have we come on these kind of important policy and different approaches? If you want to give it a grade A through F, say.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S., yes.
Well,
pardon me?
In terms of policy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There have been some steps. The Food Quality Protection Act, 1996, good step. But in terms of the issue Theo was talking about, it's close to F.
Close to F. Theo?
F.
Diane?
F.
Okay, with that, do we have any more questions?
I have a question.
Yes, please, go ahead.
I wanted to know what each of the speakers thinks would be the most effective action, three most effective actions that an average citizen can take and that a community activist, you know, acting locally can take.
Well, that's a
good... Tell us your name and affiliation, please.
I'm sorry. My name is Louise Mitchell, and I am a publicist with the Weston A. Price Foundation.
Thank you.
To take to what end?
Well,
what's your
information.
Goal?
Well, my goal is to have an impact on this information that you're presenting to the world, not only with your book, but in the past 10 years, now that you know more. What can I, as an average citizen, do in my life and in my community? You know, I work with lots of local citizens to mobilize all kinds of action in Congress and our local state level, city level. But with the broad amount of information that you know from writing the book, but also from reviewing all of this massive amount of data and information, what are the three most important things that you can see that an average citizen can do? I mean, personally, I think of going back to being an urban homesteader. That's, to me, the bottom line. It's like, live locally, grow food, don't drive my car, you know, walk to work.
Well, some of
don't
those,
drink out of plastic
some
bottles.
Of those,
I mean,
recommendations for individual action are in the book as well, but how would we improve the grade that we just mentioned, I think, is the...
Well, I've had a vision for about 6 years now that having gone to the Hill, went to the Hill one day to talk to staffers, to brief staffers on endocrine disruption and where we were, and showing these links with the fetal origins of the certain disorders. And one of those disorders was diabetes, and of course we were looking at learning disability. And down the hall was a group of people who had come in from around the country to get more attention for diabetes. To raise money and get money on the budget to look at cures for diabetes. We tried talking to that group. We were sharing the hall. You know, you're given one room to go in and you have to juggle back and forth. The interesting thing was that we could not get them interested in thinking about prevention and the message we were bringing there. And that's why I think there's so much hope in what we are doing with Shay. Because as all of these different organizations that are listening in now, you're representing a lot of organizations, we need to gang together and go as one individual or one entity on the Hill, from the diabetics to the learning disabilities, autism, everybody. We just pile in on the Hill and say, we want to seek prevention. We are here for you to put crash money into a program to turn the health situation around in this country. And so I think Shay is the answer, but how we do it and get it organized, I think Shay could possibly do this.
If I just can share that locally right now in the state of Maryland, we're working on the Healthy Air Act and just getting the local state legislature to approve cutting down four pollutants in the state and the power plants, and all the environmental groups and the health groups have formed a coalition called the Healthy Air Coalition, and it's been so effective. It looks like it's going to be probably the most effective bill, or the most strict bill, from what I hear among the country, if it works. And it's been working on all levels of action. So anyway, that may be something useful for a national
approach, yeah.
We have a related question emailed in, and actually this is something that you mentioned in your book as well, is what lessons or models might we take from the tobacco control movement?
Okay, I have an answer for that one.
Please, go ahead.
I think on the local level, the use of pesticides in the suburbs, on playing fields, where, you know, in kids' schoolyards, the use of chemical lawn services, which have drift that goes into other people's yards. You could model a campaign that would be about secondhand pesticide exposure that I think might have the potential for getting various groups together. But, I really think this daily sort of blithe use of pesticides that continues everywhere is something that really needs to be, you really need to have people rally around and address it. I mean, even the fact that public television has Scott's ads, on its gardening programs and these pictures of these weed-free lawns tells you how little progress we've made on raising public awareness. So I would really vote for that kind of campaign.
Hello, this is Marcia Marks, and I wrote in that question. I think that we're not going to get anywhere on the federal level, and it's time to go to the local level. That's what we did with tobacco, and it's been a very successful example. To get laws passed on local levels and where possible on the state levels, but we did this also with pesticides. We got our community to stop using pesticides in the government buildings. So I think it's a good, looking at tobacco, when you can't get things done on the federal level, you go to the local levels where you have some impact.
That's been true in California as well.
Right.
Do we have another question from the listeners?
This is Barbara McKelgan. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I've been working with Health Canada, and also I know the evaluation of priority chemicals that are produced in over 1 million pounds a year. We've tried to get...
Your command was not recognized. Please try again. Press the star key before and after the command.
Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, shall I continue?
Yes, question, please.
We've tried to get endocrine disruption on the list of tox data that would be looked at. We know there are no validated and standardized tests right now, but at least to have the empirical evidence brought into... some kind of a weight of evidence look.
So your question is how to prioritize?
How to prioritize. And I understand that Japan has a list of chemicals that they consider to be endocrine disruptors. How did they get that list? Did they test them? Could that be applied in the U.S. and Canada toward these chemicals?
Okay. Any one of our speakers want to take that? Prioritization? And
well, did Barbara say that OSF had the list? Is that there was
Japan, right?
Japan, I believe, has a list of 100 or so that they consider endocrine disruptors.
Well, they probably got that list based on the peer-reviewed literature that's coming out of laboratories.
I see.
Around the world. And that list is growing. No one wants to put out a list because, they don't want to take credit for it because the lists are always changing. If you contact my office, we can send you everybody's priority list of chemicals, and it's an interesting mix. But it is, a lot of this is based on what's coming from academia in some countries. Now, in this country, EPA does not look at what's coming out of the peer-reviewed literature out of academia. The work has to be done, apparently, in commercial laboratories using standard protocols. So, and until we get EPA to start dipping into that's defining these problems that Pete just talked about with bisphenol A and everything else, we have got to start leaning on that. I think there is a very important policy change that needs to be
your
made.
Your command was not recognized. Please try again.
Yeah, because
EPA should be,
after the command.
EPA should be made to get into that peer-reviewed literature and start doing their health analyses on that. I hate to say risk analysis because the old risk approach, analysis approach, is not going to work for endocrine disruption.
That's a good point. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead, please, quickly.
Hi. Yes, this is Pat Hilgard from EPA, and I am in the New Chemicals Program, and we get industrial chemical applications. We have 90
I'm
days.
I'm going to have to ask you to just, almost out of time, so just
okay.
A quick question, please.
We have 90 days to see if there's something that we want to look at and if we want to ask for any testing. And I have right now bisphenol A substitutes, and we can only ask for things that aren't too expensive. EPA is no place on finalizing guidance on this. Do you have any suggestions?
We need to help you get that routine changed, definitely.
Well, we need to. I have something I need to do in the next couple of weeks. Can I call you to talk about this?
You can talk about this afterwards. We are out of time here. So
okay.
I really do want to thank everybody for listening and calling in, and especially to our speakers. And I'm going to turn it back now to Eleni. So thank you all very much.
Thanks, Stephen. And yes, I'd also like to thank our speakers and our participants. We do have resources and background information on our website, and we may have more information posted, so keep your eye on that, and we will keep you posted on that as well. The next partnership call is on the integrity of science. That is scheduled for Friday, April 28th at 9 a.m. We will be sending out more emails to our partners about that call. Thanks very much, everyone, and have a great week.
Thank you.
Bye. Are any UAH